Welcome everybody. Today's class is called Soul Maps. And it is called so because it is mapping out our soul for us. Everybody knows the word soul, but the question is, what is a soul? We sometimes in very general terms can try to describe it as Jackie Mason is making fun of the handy abilities of Jewish husbands. And he says that if there's a car driving down the road, the husband and wife are in a car, and suddenly the car starts making some funny noises. If it's a non-Jewish husband driving, the wife goes, "What is it?" And the non-Jewish husband goes, "Oh, yes, I know. This is a timing belt." And if it's a Jewish husband driving, the wife goes, "What's this noise?" He says, I'm pretty sure it's something under the hood." "What is a soul?" "It's something under the hood." "Well, yes, I know it's something under the hood, but what is it exactly?" And this is what we are going to be talking about today. And if you know my classes already, I have a lot of toys. So I've noticed over the years that adults like playing with toys much more than kids. I'm one of them. So if we look at the world, we usually see it in 3D. But then if we look at a screen, a regular movie or our TVs, our computers, really what we see there is 2D. The screen is flat. Our understanding, our brain adds another dimension, third dimension. So that's why they have 3D movies where you get special glasses. And even though you are looking at a flat screen, it allows you to add a third dimension. So this world seems to us as a two-dimensional world, which is the only thing we see is the physical reality. Can we really perceive spirituality? If you are a person of a certain spiritual level, which I'm not, and if any one of you are, then I can promise you, you don't need these classes. You could go home now. But for other people like me, we need these glasses. And these glasses are the Torah. And specifically, we are going to be talking about the book of Tanya. This entire course is built on the book of Tanya. And this book is dedicated to explaining us what our souls are. And it's really covering many topics, but the main practical lessons that it derives is from explanation of the souls. Now, I know that many of you have studied Tanya or parts of Tanya before, and I believe these classes will be very beneficial for those who have never studied Tanya, who have studied some of it, who have studied some Hasidus before or no Hasidus. And this is because we are not going to be studying a book of Tanya as it's written. We are taking only one slice of it. And this slice is going to be about the practical application of the concept of a soul. The book of Tanya is written by the Alter Rebbe, who was born in the town of Lyozna, and then he moved to town of Lyady, and he wrote this book, Tanya. It was published in 1796. It took him 20 years to put this work together. It has been translated in several dozens of languages now and had several hundred reprints. So what is this book? This book, as the Alter Rebbe himself has said, it's not just a regular book that you read from the Torah, which there are many of those. The book, as the Alter Rebbe wrote, is a substitute for personal mentorship. He said that because I have so many students that were trying to come to me for advice, and they're asking for my guidance, and he simply did not have the time to answer everybody's questions. So he said that he's putting together a book that will allow people to get their answers instead of coming to see him personally. And the book of Tanya is really, first of all, focusing on understanding oneself. Then explaining why do we have inner struggles. Then balancing our emotions. Then dealing with our unhappiness. The fifth step is explaining the global effects of our work on ourselves, and then mastery of our emotions. Many people heard about the book of Rambam called Moreh Nevuchim, The Guide to Perplexed. And many people think of both Guide to Perplexed and Tanya as works of Jewish philosophy or Jewish mysticism or something like that. The two are very different. Guide to Perplexed, written by Rambam, is a book of philosophy that was trying to explain God, faith, and explain Jewish mysticism in secular terms. It is an important work. It is a very recommended read, but it's not what Tanya is about altogether. The Tanya is meant to be as an instruction manual. It does not deal with philosophy at all. It does not discuss faith. It doesn't prove that God exists or the Torah is true, as Rambam does in his book Guide to Perplexed. It is a book that is giving you practical tools. And it is also not a self-help book. You know, they say there's a guy who walks into a store, Barnes & Nobles, and asks, Barnes & Noble still exists?
Yeah,
okay. All bookstores have been closing down right and left. I forgot already which ones are still around. So this guy walks into Barnes & Noble and he asks, excuse me, where's your self-help section? The clerk says, if I will tell you, it'll defeat its purpose. We now have a lot of self-help books. They're very popular. But people who seek self-help books are usually people who are lacking something in their life. They are unhappy with something and they want to fix it. That's the whole idea. Alter Rebbe wrote that the Book of Tanya is for everyone, because it's not about self-help. It's not about fixing something in your life. It is about discovering an inner dimension of yourself and practical ways of doing so. Yes, it's a very good question. Self-help books usually help you in a specific area of life where you need help. I know that I am not good at organizing myself. So I get a self-help book on that. People who wrote self-help books, Anthony Robbins, Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective. The very opening of the book is saying, we are not human beings on spiritual journey. We are spiritual beings on a human journey. Just an interesting thought. So, but all of these books are written to help you with a specific area of life. Tanya is a book which is meant to help you discover your inner self. And if a person is organized enough or good enough in certain areas, he does not need certain self-help books. He doesn't need that help. But everyone needs to discover his inner self. Everyone needs those 3D glasses. And that's the difference. Therefore, Tanya is not about religion. It doesn't tell you anything about history. It doesn't debate the authenticity of anything. It is a book which is meant to help you to discover yourself. And we all heard the word Kabbalah, which is the teaching of Jewish mysticism. And Hasidus can be called the practical Kabbalah. In other words, Kabbalah is a very esoteric study. It really has very little to do with our practical life. Hasidus is the teaching that takes the practical side of it and brings it to us. And that helps us become better people. You know, we always have literature sold all over how to make this better, how to make that better. You have a car, you need to take care of it. You have this gadget, you need to take care of it. And, you know, how to make your home more energy efficient. We always read about how to make everything around us better. Well, what about making ourselves better? That's what Tanya is for. And obviously, as I said, we will not study the entire book of Tanya. We have only 6 classes. The Alter Rebbe once was pondering one letter of his book for 6 weeks. That's one letter. We have 6 weeks for the whole course. So it's going to be just one slice of Tanya. So let's start. Imagine there is an alien which is landing. This is a space shuttle. And this green alien, as you see, he's pretty happy. So this green alien comes and says, hey, I see you have here those creatures running around. They're called human. This alien meets you. You are the first human that this alien sees. And this alien is asking you, could you tell me about you guys? Who are humans? What are you like? How would you define a human to an alien? Or I could ask you a better question. When you go to a pet store and you want to get a new dog, let's say, or you want to get a bird, you want to get anything, you will ask the owner about different pets, about different dogs. He'll tell you, this dog is quieter, this dog is more aggressive, this dog is kind, this dog is more loyal. He'll describe to you each dog, each breed, each type, each individual dog. So if you would have to describe humans to this alien right here, what would you say? The first question that he would want to know, if he's just coming to Earth, he doesn't know anything. He wants to know, are humans good or are they bad? Should I stay away from them? Should I be scared of them? Because this guy looks pretty nice and very happy, harmless. He won't hurt anyone. But my question is, he's asking, who are humans? I have here this little baby. I think he looks even cuter than the alien. So is this little baby good or bad? Are we born good or are we born bad? Is this little baby something like this? Or is he something like this? Are we good or are we bad? Or can we become good? Can we become bad? So what would you say? Any thoughts? Well, when you look at this baby, you are pretty convinced that we are born good. This baby definitely looks like he was born good. Okay, so you tell me. Okay, so in other words, Eric is saying that some humans are born good and some humans are born bad. So this alien will be pretty interested by such an answer. Yes, Alan, what do you say? I wouldn't say that somebody who is uncircumcised is necessarily a bad person. I've met a couple of people who have been uncircumcised for whatever reason it is, and they're pretty decent human beings. I've also met those who are circumcised and pretty rotten. Alan is saying that we are born bad and we need to make ourselves better. In other words, we are born good, like this little guy, but then we become bad because of all the outside influences. Just like your phone. When you get your phone, first it works well, but then it starts getting all these bugs, and then it doesn't charge properly, and then this breaks and that breaks. So over the time, it becomes bad because of outside influences. If you'll not use your phone and have it in your closet without ever taking it out of the house, probably it's not going to have any bugs. Okay, here you go. I hear you. If we are created in the image of God, then we are all good. So, you know what? Usually, rabbis, when they hear different opinions, they say, you're right, and you're right. In this instance, I will have to be an atypical rabbi. I'll say, you are wrong, and you are wrong. But we are all equally wrong, so nobody feels bad. We are talking now from the Torah's perspective. There are different ideologies about this. For example, there is a school of thought, which is usually associated with the liberal thinking, that people are inherently good unless they are being corrupt by outside influences. And this is why these ideas that poverty creates crime. Why? Because people on their own cannot come to murder someone. But if they are poor, this is an outside influence that will make them criminals. And the same ideology believes that people become terrorists because they feel no hope in the future and they don't feel secure about their lives. And that's why they want to help those areas where terrorists come from in order to stop terrorism. Whenever I hear all this, I say, well, you know what? My grandparents grew up in a shtetl, in a village in Russia, or whatever, Ukraine, Belarus, in the Russian Empire, where they had utter poverty, and every time the government was making new laws to stifle their future. And you know what? None of them turned out to be a criminal or a terrorist. These Jewish shtetlach, the Jewish villages, had less crime than the safest neighborhoods in America today. People never locked their doors. and people made business deals with each other just on a handshake. So there is an ideology that believes that people are born good and they become bad only because of outside influences. Then there is an ideology that believes that people are bad, they're inherently bad, and there's nothing you can do about it. One of very prominent bearers of this idea is Christian thought, because we are all born, according to Christianity, in sin. We are all sinners. That's why we all have to repent. As soon as a child is born, he has to repent, because everybody's born bad. And then there is an idea that people are born bad, but they can become good as a result of something. For example, this is why in the secular world there were a lot of emphasis on education. And when the Nazi Germany started murdering Jews, when they saw what was going on, everybody was surprised. This was the most educated country in the world. How could such an educated people do such an evil thing? So people believe that education somehow makes people better. And once you go through a certain system, you become permanently good. You cannot do evil things anymore. Well, as we said already, the Torah is disagreeing with all three of these views. A, we are not born good. B, we are not born bad. C, we cannot become permanently good or permanently bad because of something that we do to ourselves, or because of some system that we go through, or because of something which is done to us. I want to ask you a question. You all have met people who made their resolutions and didn't keep them, whether it was a birthday resolution, a New Year resolution. Obviously, it was never you. You have never had such experience. But I'm sure you know people who made a resolution and said, okay, from New Year's, from January 1st, I go to gym every single day. By the way, you know that at the beginning of January, that's when all gyms sell their memberships. It's the most profitable time for them because everybody buys membership, but nobody ever goes to gym afterwards. So they get the money without having these people come. Or usually people start, like they go first few days of January or first couple of months, they're there, and then that's it. Now, you made a resolution not to eat anything sweet. You see, like this guy, not to eat cake. And then you are sitting in front of this choice over here. One second. I want cake. And I also want apple. I want cake, well, because it tastes good. I want an apple, well, because it's healthy. So my question is, which one is real me? Which one is real me? What do you think? The cake one or the apple one? You are saying some people, their real I, their real identity is this cake, and their desire for apple is superimposed. And for another person, his real identity is wanting apple, and his desire for this piece of cake is superimposed. A very good question. Are desires equal to my identity? But where do my desires come from? Here's another example. My alarm clock is ringing, and it is, according to this picture, it's 10:06 in the morning, and I'm still very, very tired. It's Shabbat morning, and we had a very lively Friday night meal the night before. We had a lot of guests. And it is 10:06 in the morning, and I have to get up because the services in the synagogue started already some time ago. And at least if I'll get up now, I might make it for the Torah reading. I want to stay in bed because I'm tired, but I also want to get up. So which one is real me? Why is one me having two opposite desires? So I will tell you that the entire book of Tanya is based on the idea that we really have, each one of us has two souls. And we are going to be talking about these two souls that we have. So really, there is two of you sitting here in front of me. Each one of you is double, so it's a W. Why two souls? So we are going to be now talking about what are these two souls. First of all, the Alter Rebbe didn't invent this idea. It is based on a verse from Yeshayahu and in several other places. When God is speaking about one individual, God said, Neshamot ani asiti. I made him souls in plural. Well, plural, minimum of plural is two. So it implies that a person has at least two souls. One of them is the animalistic soul, animal soul. The other one is called the godly soul. So let's talk about this animalistic soul. What is it? I want, because of this soul, whatever every animal wants, which is what? My desire for self-preservation, for life. And now, many people confuse it with bad or evil soul. It's not true. An animal is not evil. Animal could be very instinctive. The thing is, it is self-oriented. And you know what? It can do good. It is a natural level of non-holiness. There's a very important difference between unholy and non-holy. Just like things can be amoral and immoral. Immoral means something which is contradicting morality. Amoral means something which is void of morality. It's not contradicting morality, but it is also not aligned with morality. Something could be non-holy or something could be unholy. Non-holy means there's no holiness there. Unholy means it is contradicting holiness. What does it mean? Look at an animal. An animal can do very good things. Some animals are very kind. Animals are very loyal. Animals are capable of loving. Animals take care of their kids, at least many of them. Animals want their physical needs to be met. They want to have a better life. They want to have a comfort. And they all have emotional needs. They want to be loved. They want to feel good about themselves. So when I love someone, in many cultures, the idea of love is something holy, godly, something which is transcending our own nature. But why? Animals also can love. If I love ice cream, do I really love ice cream? No. You know what? If I would love ice cream, I would lock it up in the freezer and never touch it. I eat it. If you love ice cream and you eat it, I really hope you'll never love me, because then I guess you'll eat me too. When I say I love ice cream, I don't really mean I love ice cream. What I mean is I love myself, and I love what ice cream does to me. So this is a self-interest. I could love other people because I love what they do to me. This guy has a good sense of humor. This woman is looking pretty. This guy is very handsome and strong. Whatever things attract us to others, why is this characteristic attracting this person to me or me to this person? Because I see something which I like for myself in this person, and that's why I'm feeling attraction. It's for myself, just like an animal can love its owners, its masters. Why? Because they take good care of it. There's a trait that makes these animals love this person. Now, it's very, very important. Our animalistic soul is not bad, not evil, and it can even do very good and very holy things. Why? Because I can donate millions of dollars to build a new hospital. Why? Just because I want to be famous. I can donate $1,000. Why? Because I want to feel good about myself. I can donate $1 to a beggar on the street just to quench my emotion of pity to this person. Why am I doing it? I'm all doing it for myself, but I'm doing great things. The kids are being treated in this hospital now because of my desire to be famous. This school is going to have my $1,000 because I want to feel good about myself. So our animalistic soul can sometimes drive us to do terrible things. And people do a lot of very bad things because of their self-interest. Our animalistic soul can push us to do totally neutral things, like having a sip of water. Is there anything wrong with drinking this water? No. Is there anything right with drinking this water? Also not. I just decided to take a sip. I'm drinking it. And then my animalistic soul can push me to do great things. Very often you hear someone saving somebody, risking his life to save someone. And then he's been asked, why did you do that? What pushed you to do this heroic act? What does he say? Well, if I wouldn't do it, I wouldn't be able to live with myself. So he has a certain image of himself, and this image compels him to do it, which is a great thing. He saved someone's life. I wish everybody would have such a self-image that's going to be pushing them to do these heroic acts. But which side of him pushed him do it? His self-image, his desire to look a certain way in his own eyes, which is his animalistic self. So, is selfishness a bad thing? It depends. If you are Karl Marx, then you believe that selfishness is a bad thing. Because he was trying to create the world without selfishness. That's why he wanted to eliminate money and private property and everything else. But then there's a system of capitalism, which probably most of us agree is a little better than communism. And the idea of capitalism is that I can use people's selfishness to compel them to do good things. Do you know why somebody is producing sneakers? Not because he really wants people to have good sneakers and really good footwear for when they're working out. He couldn't care less whether they're going to have good footwear or bad footwear. He wants to make money. But to make money, you have to make sneakers, at least in his case. That's why he's making sneakers. So his selfishness is being utilized for something good. Is selfishness always utilized for good things? No. I'm sure all of you know cases where selfishness turned out to be pushing people to do bad things. So selfishness can be good, can be bad. So now, not every time, but often, when we are doing good things, sometimes we are pushed, propelled by our animalistic self. And there's nothing wrong with it. Whenever people talk to me, they often say, this person, he does a mitzvah, but he doesn't do it from his pure heart. He doesn't really believe in it. He doesn't really want to do it. And I always tell people, first of all, who am I judge? Whose desires are pure and whose desires are not pure. I have no clue and I will never know. I sometimes can't figure out whether my desires are pure or not. Never mind other people's, first of all. But second of all, if somebody does something good, I couldn't care less why he does it. Just like I brought an example of somebody donating money to build a hospital. I don't care why he built a hospital. Or smaller things. He helped his neighbor. He said hello to somebody. He smiled at someone. He came to shul to put on tefillin. Why did he come to shul to put on tefillin? I know, really, he came to shul to put on tefillin only because he has an important meeting this afternoon and he wants to do a mitzvah to buy a favor from God. That's why he's putting on tefillin. You know what? Maybe that's true. So what? He's doing something good. A very good question. You know, this is what Yulia is saying is a very good point. There is a reason why the study of Jewish mysticism has been with the Jews throughout the history. And it was at a time when European Jews were experiencing a very difficult period after Bogdan Khmelnytsky's pogroms, which were pretty much in most of Eastern Europe. This is when the study of Jewish mysticism has dwindled down. Why? Because while Jews were in their communities, attending proper yeshivas, they were getting proper education, they were studying the Jewish law, and they were studying mysticism as well. Or the ideas of mysticism were permeated throughout their study of the law and everything, Talmud. But then, when Jews were experiencing difficult times, many of them weren't able to attend yeshivas. So this Jew is coming to his rabbi, and he tells him, Rabbi, please tell me if this is kosher or this is not kosher. The philosophy, soul, I couldn't care less. I want to know how to live as a proper Jew. I want to do right things according to the Torah. Tell me what to do. Don't tell me about my soul, my spirituality, my inner self. I couldn't care less. Why did they have such an approach? This approach was correct because behavior is the main thing. So the code of Jewish law is talking only about behavior. Talmud is talking about what we need to do. That is the bulk of the Jewish studies. And your question is precisely explaining why the study of Jewish mysticism was put on the back burner at the times when Jews had to choose what to study because their resources were limited. Judaism is a behavioral system. You need to do the right things. That's number one. Then, once you do all the right things, or not once you do the right, but once you are working already on doing the right things, you can also work on making sure that your emotions are in line with them. But firstly, you need to pay attention to your actions. The book of Tanya is based on one verse in the Torah that says, this mitzvah is close to you. So the Alter Rebbe is saying that he's going to explain how is it that mitzvahs are close to us emotionally. And the Alter Rebbe is explaining to us how we can develop this closeness. And he says that there are two ways to do it, and he's going to explain both of them. But yes, primarily we need to pay attention to our actions, and our emotions are secondary. But they are also important. So now, we are talking now about our animalistic soul, and we found out that you can do bad things because of it. You can do neutral things because of it. You can do good things because of it. You can do great things because of it. You can do mitzvahs because of it. So now, I want to ask you, so then I have my entire complex of what I need from a soul. What is missing? What cannot I do with my animalistic soul? Spiritual things, depending how you define spiritual. Because if you say mitzvahs are spiritual things, I can do mitzvahs. What is it? Intellectual. Well, we're going to be talking about our intellect in a minute. So, guilt, if you are Jewish, that's what you have 24/7. My shoulds, you mean to compel yourself to do things you don't want to do, like waking up in the morning. Well, my animalistic soul could make me wake up in the morning. If I know that I'm going to get fired from my job if I'll come late, my animalistic soul is going to get me out of bed most of the time. Get closer to God. Here you go. So Roman said it in a convoluted way, spiritual. And I like said, depends how you define spirituality. But here Vita says something, get closer to God. So now, this world can be good, fair, moral, just, without us having godly souls. What is godly soul needed for? The answer is nothing. To you, godly soul is needed for nothing. You cannot benefit from it at all. If your you is your self-interest, then there's nothing godly soul can do to you. Why? Because godly soul, by definition, is selfless. Selflessness means doing something for others, doing something that against your own interests, doing something that hurts you. So if people are doing something which is truly against their interests, that can be done only as a result of their godly soul, because godly soul is selfless. Why is that? It is because of the source of our soul. You see, when animals or birds or trees or inanimate nature were created, God created everybody with a one-step process. God said, let there be birds, and birds appeared. God said, let there be trees, and trees appeared. But when God created a human, God created our bodies, just like everything else, and then says God breathed the soul. God blew the soul of Adam into him. Now, when you blow something, you blow from within yourself. God gave him a piece of himself. God gave Adam a piece of himself. So our souls, our godly souls, are a piece of God, and that's why they are selfless. You see, an animal is living. Everything is living. An animal is living. A tree is living. A bird is living. And the soul which is making it live, making it be alive, is preoccupied with making sure it's going to be alive and comfortable. That's a self-interest. And then humans have an additional soul. A second soul came into us. That's why the Alter Rebbe is calling it a second soul. This is an extra soul. And it's not there to make us alive. It's not even there to make us happy. It's there to make us godly. This world can be good, moral, just, fair, kind, loving, without godly souls. This world cannot be godly without godly soul. Yes. Right. So who says that my love to my children is different than animals' love to its children? It's not self, no. People view their children as an extension of themselves. That's human nature, that's an animal nature. When I'm doing something for my kids, I'm not selfless. Sorry. Grandkids, a different story. No, I'm kidding. Now, we see the difference between the two souls. One is life force, the other one is called a second soul. One is created with speech, the other one is created with breath from within God. One is selfish, one is selfless. Let's try to fill out this chart. The difference between one is selfish, one is altruistic. One is embodied in the blood, because blood is the source of our lives, and a limb that doesn't have any blood coming to it is going to die. The other one is in our body, but not in our blood. As a matter of fact, it says, just like God is filling this world, our souls, which is our godly souls, are filling our bodies. God is in this world, but where exactly? I don't know. Same thing is my soul. My soul is in my body. Where exactly? I don't know. It's everywhere. Just like God is everywhere in this world, my soul is everywhere in my body. One is seeking pleasure, the other one is seeking godliness. One is primal soul, the other one is called the second soul. One is relating to the natural, the other one is relating to the transcendent. Now, I want to ask you a question. How do you define altruistic acts? What is a selfless deed? Very often, we confuse altruistic with something which is going against certain desires. What is it? Thinking. Thinking is selfless. I could be thinking for selfish reasons. You gave me something, I'll thank you because I know that if I'll thank you, you'll give it to me again. Selfish is something that causes me discomfort. Well, here's an example, Giordano Bruno. As you know, in the 16th century, he was the one who was saying that there are other galaxies, other solar systems. He made many other discoveries about the universe that were going against the church's doctrine back then. And he made a mistake that cost him his life. He moved to Italy. And there he was offered to recant, to disavow his scientific beliefs. And if he would not do that, he would be burnt at a stake. He would be killed. So now he refused to disavow his beliefs and he was killed. So now I want to ask you a question. Was this a selfish act or selfless act? Why selfish? He knew he'll be in Wikipedia later on. He wanted to become famous. I understand. Every religion and every ideology has martyrs who have been giving up their lives for their beliefs. Why is it? It can be for a very simple reason. This person has his belief and he has his life. Now, he's given a choice. Either depart with your belief and you'll save your life, or depart with your life and stay with your belief. He has to make a choice. In some cases, it is easier for a person to depart with his faith and stay with his life. In other cases, a person might feel that it is easier for him to depart with his life and stay with his faith. It depends what is easier for me to do. It's my choice. If I feel stronger attachment to my faith, I might say, you know what? I'm ready to die for it. When a terrorist is giving up his life to blow himself up and cause harm and, God forbid, maybe even death to others, is he being selfless? No, he believes that he's going to get 72 versions up there. That's why he's doing it. He's not being selfless, but he's giving up his life. You see, in the Western world, people tend to think that life is the most precious thing we have. That's why whenever somebody's giving up his life, it's like, oh, wow, he's selfless. Not necessarily. So world selflessness is used very, very loose in our society. But in the Torah, selflessness is described something which is going truly against your interest. For example, by the way, we were speaking about people giving up their lives for their beliefs. Interestingly enough, the Alter Rebbe, in his book of Tanya, is saying that if a Jew who believes in something is giving up his life for whatever he believes, that's not necessarily a selfless act, because he might be just doing it because he wants to stay with his ideology. It's more important to him than his physical life. But, the Alter Rebbe is saying, the example from the era right after pogroms of Bogdan Khmelnytsky, we were saying, this was pretty much the first time that Jews in the mass, large groups of Jews were raised without any Jewish education. There were Jews who wanted to be good Jews, but they didn't know how to. These Jews didn't know basics. They were actually, as a matter of fact, unfortunately, laughed at by the educated elite of the Jews. And back then there was this split between the elites, who were very few, and the masses. This is a sad page of our Jewish history, but it did happen. And Jews wanted to be Jews. They wanted to be Jews. They didn't know how to. They didn't go to synagogues. They didn't know how to read Hebrew. They were actually chastised by other Jews. Other Jews, the educated elite, were often calling them non-Jews. They were calling them goyim. And then the Christian church was always trying to convert Jews to their faith. Thought, oh, that's our golden opportunity. Why? Because till now, Jews were raised in their faith. And obviously, nobody would give up their faith. Christians who were raised in their faith would never give up their faith. So Jews also didn't. That's what they thought. But now, when there's a large number of Jews who were not raised in Jewish faith, they actually don't even know how to practice their faith. They know nothing about their faith. And they're laughed at by their own rabbis, the educated elite of their community. So now we couldn't get them. And this is when they came to to the Jews en masse and they were trying to convert them. And Jews, in the vast majority of cases, they were refusing to give up their Judaism. But one second, what's their Judaism? They know nothing about their Judaism. They only know that they're Jewish. That's the only thing they know. They don't even know what it means to be Jewish. They don't know how to live like a Jew. But they were ready to give up their lives for what? They themselves don't know for what. And the Alter Rebbe was saying, that is an example of a completely selfless act. They're not dying for their ideology. You'll ask them, what am I dying for? I don't know, what am I dying for? I really don't know. Anything that has a logical explanation is selfish because I can explain to myself why I'm doing it. The fact that I cannot explain it is a sign of being selfless. Well, selflessness is never smart. It's never prudent. If there is any benefit, what do you call being smart? When you say, well, this was a smart investment means I gained something from it. This was a smart move. Smart move means that it brought something to me. If I did a move that made me lose everything I had, that wasn't a smart move. We call smart things that I gained something from. Yes, anything that a godly soul compels me to do is not smart, in this sense, because it is going against my interests. So I'm not saying that every stupid move is selfless. There are many stupid moves which are quite selfish. But sometimes we are doing things which are against our own interests, and we can't even explain ourselves why we're doing it. And that is the way how I can know that somebody is being selfless. Like I said, I will never judge anyone's motives, and I will never take upon myself to decide whether somebody is selfish or selfless. But there are some telltale signs. And now, by the way, I make a point to speak to you in theory. I would never say, oh, this guy is doing something. He's doing it for whatever reason, selfish, selfless, I don't know, whatever. I would never know. But I can probably assume that there is a huge gray area where I will never know, probably nobody will ever know. But then there are some acts which I know for sure selfless. And then there are some acts which I know for sure are selfish. Okay? So a sign of a selfless act if it brings no benefit to me. Now, a person might be mistaken. He might think that something brings a benefit and it doesn't, or the other way around. So you need to also take into account his own calculation. So let's move on. I want to cover one more topic. The Alter Rebbe is explaining to us that if we are having two souls, this is an explanation why we are having conflicting desires. Other religions very often come to you and promise tranquility and peace of mind if you will follow them. Once you will convert to our religion, you'll adopt our ideology, you're gonna attain a state of peace and quiet. The Torah is saying the exact opposite. The Torah is explaining why this state of being torn by different opposite desires is a normal thing. That's because we have this godly soul. Yes, one part of me might want one thing, another part of me might want another thing. And that is being a human with two souls. And the Alter Rebbe is explaining to us that the two souls are battling, like two kings are fighting over one city. Many people would want to live in a world with no criminals, nobody doing anything bad, nobody being selfish, nobody stealing from anyone, nobody cheating. And people are trying to figure out, how do we make this world? Oh, if I'll do this, then people will stop doing bad things. The Alter Rebbe is saying, no. It's a human nature. We always have a part of us that wants to do bad things, and that's fine. We just need to know that it is our animalistic soul. If you have an animal, those of you who have pets at home, know that animal needs to have two things. Number one, an animal needs to be sometimes controlled. You need to train your animal and tell it what it can do, what it cannot do. And then the animal also needs to be channeled, its energy needs to be channeled. People today don't use animals for anything. If we have cats or dogs at home, it's usually just for having a cat or dog. But people used to have dogs to guard and cats as a pest control and cows to give milk, and they had horses as a means of transportation. So animals can be very good. Their energy has to be channeled. If I channel my animal's energy, it's going to be doing good things. If I let my animal roam around, probably bad things gonna happen. How do I control and how do I channel my animal? You probably saw this chart before. These are the 10 sefirot. And Kabbalah is explaining the three top ones. are the intellectual faculties. 7 bottom one are emotions, and these are called soul's faculty. Now, then, besides for soul's faculties, there are also soul's garments. Garments are thoughts, speech, and action. What is the difference between faculties and garments? Faculties are a part of us. My emotions, what I want, if I suddenly want something, is a part of me. My garments, the Torah is calling them garments precisely because garments I can put on and take off. I could wear a suit today. I could have came wearing, you know, t-shirt and jogging pants. Why? Because I can. I choose what to wear. So garments I can take off and put on. Faculties are part of me. Why is it important? It is important because I'm not in control immediately of my faculties. If I have a certain desire right now, should I feel bad about it? Well, maybe I need to work myself in the future, and it's possible to put a lot of work and master my desires on some level. But really, I will always have bad desires. I shouldn't feel bad about having bad desires. Now, acting upon them, that's a different story. These are my garments. I can put them on and take them off. And this is, by the way, a very big difference between Judaism and Christianity. In Christianity, having a bad desire is considered a sin. In Judaism, this Jew is sitting in a shul in the synagogue on Yom Kippur when you're supposed to fast, and he says, I want to eat. How dare you? You have a desire which is against the Torah. But I'm hungry. No. Torah says you're not allowed to eat. You can't control your desires. There's a story about Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was not a very big friend of Jews in Israel, but this story actually says something very positive about him. When he was running for being president, he was asked, just imagine the difference between campaigns back then, a couple decades ago, and now. He was asked whether he ever felt the feeling of lust to another woman besides for his wife. And he answered honestly. He said, yes. Once I had a person working in my office, a woman working in my office, and I felt an attraction to her. And I felt terrible about it. And I made sure to move her. He was in charge of a big office. I moved her in a different department where I would not meet with her without her losing any of her pay or experience and so on and so forth. She didn't lose anything out of it, but I felt that's the only way how I can save my marriage. The entire country went in uproar. Such a terrible person. He fell in love with another woman besides for his wife. He's a bad man. According to the Torah, he's not a bad man. He's a man. We are not in charge of our feelings. He did the right thing by making sure not to act on his emotions and to make sure to protect himself from falling into this trap. He did the right thing. Now we understand the difference between our soul faculties and soul garments. And as we see here, they could be good or they could be bad. It's up to us. I can choose. So faculties are internal, garments are external. Faculties are character, garments are behavior. Faculties are self, it is myself. My garments are my self-expression. Faculties are inside, garments are outside. Faculties are what I want, my garments are what I do. And you know what? Both animalistic and godly soul have all 10 faculties, and both of them can have all 3 garments, speech, thought, and action. And all of it can be good or bad. Now, I want to ask you a question. If I would give you a challenge, can you not eat your favorite food for a year if I'll give you $1 million? Probably most of you would take the challenge. $1 million is a lot of money, even counting the inflation. You know, you could live without your favorite food for a year. What if I'll tell you that I'll give you this $1 million if you'll start hating your favorite food? And I have a very good lie detector who's going to be really figuring out whether you love or hate something. So will you take this challenge? Because if you fail, you'll have to pay me $1 million. Probably not, because everybody's very quiet. Why? What's the difference? The difference is because I can hold myself back from eating my favorite food, but I can't start hating it. I cannot make myself love or hate something like this. That's the difference between garments and faculties. And the Torah is telling us that our garments is the main thing which we need to focus on. And this is specifically what Yulia was mentioning before, that my actions is the main thing which determines whether I'm doing what a Jew is supposed to, whether I'm living like a Jew is supposed to, whether I like it or not. If I hate matzah, but I eat it on Pesach, I fulfill the mitzvah. If I love matzah, but I don't eat it, I don't fulfill the mitzvah. But I love it. The mitzvah is not to love, the mitzvah is to eat. Now we understand what soul is and how it expresses itself. Now, I want to ask you a question. There are some things which are non-holy, and then there are things which are holy, and then there are things which are unholy. You remember we spoke about it. And the Torah is explaining to us that really, vast majority of this world is this middle area, which is not unholy, just non-holy. And it is our job to change it into something holy. So my animalistic soul is not unholy, it is non-holy. My goal is to make it do holy things. I can make my animalistic soul want to do the right things. This is what we do with kids. We tell them, if you get an A, I'm going to buy you a prize. Now, I make them want get an A. If you'll clean your room, I will let you go outside. Now they want to clean the room. I'm manipulating them. Education, raising children is an art of manipulation. You manipulate them. You know what? We manipulate adults also. Every single one of you sitting here is being manipulated by your boss or your clients. Your client or your boss says, if you'll do A, B, and C, I'll give you money. Now you want to do A, B, and C. So just like we manipulate our kids, just like our bosses at work or our clients in the business manipulate us, we need to manipulate our non-holy animalistic soul. And there are things which are completely forbidden. And by the way, in Hebrew, forbidden means asur, which means it's tied. Word asur in Hebrew means tied. Prohibited and tied in Hebrew, same word. And mutar, which means permitted, means unbound, untied. Why? Because things which are tied down, I cannot elevate them. But things which are mutar, which means allowed, I can elevate them. They are not holy. They are not holy, but I can elevate them. And that's why they are called mutar, which means untied, unbound. Now, I want to ask you a question. You all know Maslow's pyramid, right? So now, the very bottom is our physical needs, then safety needs, love and belonging, esteem, self-actualization. Where in this pyramid is there a break between our godly soul and our animalistic soul? Which need of these is the one of our godly soul and which one is of our animalistic soul? All of them what? Very good, 100%. All of them are animalistic. Because my desire for self-esteem, self-actualization, it's all animalistic soul. Very good, yes. Animalistic does not mean unholy. Animalistic means non-holy, which means void of holiness. If I take a car and drive it, like you said, to a synagogue, the car itself was non-holy, and I made it into holy. If I have my car driving me to do something bad, then it's becoming unholy. Now, if I am making it drive me just for a drive around the city just because I'm bored, it was non-holy. It is still non-holy. So Maslow's pyramid is showing us our selfish desires, which are a result of our animalistic soul. They can be turned into something good, every single one of them. My physical needs, my safety needs, a desire for love and belonging can be turned into something positive. 100%. That's why we need our animalistic soul. I agree with you. Nowhere in the Torah does anyone argue for elimination of our animalistic desires. We need them. The goal is to control and channel the animal, not to kill the animal. If you remember, I told you about your pets. The desires that I have need to be controlled and channeled, but never killed. Let's go over what we learned today. Key points. Number one, we have two souls, an animal soul and a godly soul. Number two, the animal soul is selfish and concerned primarily with self-preservation, while godly soul is selfless and concerned with godliness. Number three, each soul has 10 faculties, 3 cognitive and 7 emotional, and it's mirroring the 10 sephirot. Now, this is both souls equal. There are 3 garments of external expressions, our thoughts, our speech, and our actions. The animal soul is rooted in kelipot noga, neutral, not holiness, this is just a Kabbalistic term for it, which has the potential for being elevated into holiness. Number six, the 3 utterly unclean kipot, however, are eternally irredeemable and cannot be elevated to holiness. Now, this was our first class. Thank you very much. I also hope to see you here next week, same time, same place. And like I said, please sign up. If you sign up, you get the recordings of each class. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them now.